NPR regrets to announce that this will be the final episode of It's All Politics from NPR News. Yay!
April Fools.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
No, you're not. And another April Fool's joke, and I'm Ken Rudin.
And you are the April Fool. So let me just ask you, Ken, what story sticks in your mind from the incredible major national news developments of this past week?
Recess appointments.
Could be recess appointments. Work with me now. Work with me. Could be the president goes to Kabul. The president goes to Portland, Maine. The president goes to Boston, Massachusetts. The president goes to Charlotte, North Carolina.
You know
what?
Could
be what's moving in terms of the jobs in our economy. Up, down, which way is it going?
You're right.
Drill, baby, drill. The president changes his policy on offshore drilling for oil and natural gas.
You're right. We lead with Michael Steele and lesbian bondage clubs in West Hollywood.
Oh, that would be cheap. That would be cheap. A lot of news organizations have fallen for that catnip. They have gone down that road.
But
this podcast is going to hold its head high
Ron,
and say, we're not going to talk about leather bondage, lesbian simulated acts in West Hollywood when we've got more important issues right here in Washington, D.C.
This week, the week of Passover, we celebrate the Jewish people's freedom from bondage in Egypt. What better way to bring up bondage than the problems with the Republican National Committee?
Is that why Carly Fiorina wanted to talk about it out there in California?
She sent out an email to Jewish supporters saying maybe we could break bread during this Passover holiday.
Right. You know, Ken, you're a Jew.
Good tonight.
Is it not the custom to remove all ordinary bread, all leavened bread, from the home for the Passover time?
I wish there was somebody we could turn to find out really what Passover was all about.
And so the reason we celebrate the Passover holidays by eating matzoth is to commemorate the time that Moses led the children of Israel from Egypt.
Well, certainly we made that clear.
I think we did. And I'm hoping now with the Easter holiday coming up that Carly Fiorina can return and urge everyone to have a little unleavened lamb.
Right, and we can invite former Congressman Norman Lent.
That would be also an or former Congressman Nathan Deal, who's made quite a deal of his campaign thus far for governor of Georgia.
Probably the worst segue in It's All Politics history, but having said that, Nathan Deal, FDR, of course, had the New Deal. Harry
Joe
Truman.
Biden had the BF deal.
Right. And Georgia has Nathan Deal running for governor. He quit Congress the day after the health care vote.
So did I.
But the thing is, he hoped to get out of Congress before an ethics committee was looking into his own family's business and what steps he may have taken to benefit his own family's business at the expense of the state government. And he, by leaving Congress, usually the ethics committee drops these kind of things, but they actually released a report even after he left Congress saying that he may have used some untoward activities.
Why would they do that? Why would they release a report even after he had left
Congress? Well, actually,
That seems ill-tempered.
Well, actually, Nathan Deal said that this was political in nature, and that even though the House Ethics Committee is bipartisan, in other words, members of both Republicans and Democrats, it's Nancy Pelosi's people who run the staff there, and that's why they did it.
I see. Well, that covers a lot of the news in kind of one sweep, but let's just raise one serious issue about an issue that, of course, is not inherently serious. This business that went on at the Voyeur Club in West Hollywood did call attention to what may be a more serious matter at the Republican National Committee, and that is that while they have set records for fundraising thus far under the leadership of Chairman Michael Steele, they have also set records for spending the money as they brought it in. And in certain periods, they've actually been spending it faster than it came in.
They've absolutely spent it more than they're taking in. Now, they will argue that, of course, we had victories in New Jersey and Virginia and Scott
those were
Brown.
All, of course, the work of the Republican National
Committee. Well, they'll say they spent a lot of money in it. Now,
what about Scott Brown? Can they take some credit for Scott Brown? Did they believe in him early? Were they in there with ads, billboards, television time? Were they in there with something that made
it? No, but there was an under-the-radar bit of stuff by the Republicans, and perhaps the RNC. I mean, the DNC were actually talking taunting Republicans, saying, if you believe so much in Scott Brown, why aren't big Republicans coming to Massachusetts? I suspect that whatever money was spent by the RNC on Scott Brown's behalf was under the radar, not to make it a Republican effort in, of all states, Massachusetts.
That's right. Much of that taunt was about why don't major figures of the Republican Party go in there to campaign for him. And in fact, the Republicans were keeping them out so that Scott Brown could run as a kind of insurgent, as an outsider. Now, in fairness, Michael Steele did not attend this bit of a party that was held.
And the reason you know that is because you were looking for him there?
We have been told, and apparently no one is contradicting this, no one has ever averred that he was there.
No.
We have been told he was not there. It was a gathering of a group called the Young Eagles, and that they were gathered by our Republican staffer and by a Republican donor, and that they were having an evening, and that they would have paid for it in other means, but for one reason or another it wound up on this RNC card, somebody got reimbursed, and so on. And it's just one incident. But there is a great deal of unhappiness already among Republican donors because of these spending habits, because some people don't like Michael Steele's own personal style. And as a result, for example, I just saw a poll this morning in Politico.com saying that 44% of Republicans say in a poll that they don't want to give money to the RNC anymore because they don't think it shares their values. And Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council has actually gone so far as to tell his group's members, don't give money to the RNC anymore, just give to individual Republicans.
Right, give it to individual. Look, the fact is they spent $17,000 on private jets, $13,000 on
private sharks.
The thing is about money and about the use of money, and that's why Tony Perkins has said his thing. That's why a lot of Republicans have said their thing. The ultimate question is Michael Steele endangered? He may be gone by after the midterm elections.
Oh, he's a one-term guy. Yeah. It's a two-year job. Yeah. And you either get a second term or you don't get a second term. I think it's pretty clear he's not going to get a second term. He's been way too controversial.
But I still think that he stays
it's
through November.
It's a bigger bad story for them if they dump him now than if they let him go through the rest of the year, assuming that nothing else happens that makes it more embarrassing.
Well, if you think of all the headlines that have followed Michael Steele's either comments or actions since he became RNC chair, those headlines have been pretty embarrassing. And yet,
almost adds up to Joe Biden.
Well, they're not dumping Joe Biden. I don't think they're going to dump Michael Steele either.
Okay, speaking of Joe Biden, his boss had quite a week. After the passage of health care, after the reaching of an agreement with the Russians to reduce nuclear arsenals, the president decided to build on his momentum by taking a quickie trip, a secret trip, that Scott Horsley, NPR correspondent, was one of the few reporters brought along on. They flew to Kabul overnight Saturday night last weekend. Then they had some helicopters in the dark that took them back and forth from the Air Force Base to the presidential palace.
Meeting with President Karzai.
Meeting there with Hamid Karzai. And it was all kind of almost a cloak and dagger kind of an operation so that the president could essentially have kind of a woodshed session with Hamid Karzai saying, look, we're not seeing action on corruption. We're not seeing you guys dial back the corruption and share power with your rivals, and then have some quality time with the troops.
You know, it's interesting, perhaps when you think of two ostensible U.S. allies, Israel and Afghanistan, President Obama...
Probably the first time they've been thought of in the same sense.
Well, but the point is that in the past couple of weeks, taking to the woodshed is what Barack Obama did to both Netanyahu of Israel and Karzai of Afghanistan, expressing displeasure in friendly terms about their actions regarding the settlements in East Jerusalem or the corruption in Afghanistan.
And back then in the United States, more recently, then the president reversed a position that had been a mainstay, really, of his presidential campaign, both in the primary and in the general election. Opposing new offshore drilling for oil and natural gas was a big part of the Obama mantra. And now all of a sudden, maybe it's not drill, baby, drill, but it's let's open up some of those lands off states that are apparently willing to open up their shorelines on the East Coast and the Gulf Coast. Let's expand the area where we can drill for oil and gas.
In fairness to President Obama, he never said that we would not be drilling. He did, of course, oppose from the beginning the drilling in Anwar in the great Arctic region in Alaska.
In Bristol Bay,
where the Republicans talked about it with the chants during the St. Paul Republican Convention.
Drill, baby, drill. Drill, baby, drill.
And also during the State of the Union, he talked about, look, you know, we have to balance the need for environmental protection with the need for more oil. Now, the thing is, a lot of people feel that what President Obama did this week was an attempt to reach out to Republicans by saying, look, I'll go along with some of the drilling that you want, albeit 50 miles off the coast of Virginia and perhaps down the Atlantic seaboard, and some drilling in Alaska, in hoping to get some Republicans for his climate control bill that's languishing in the Senate.
You know, you could even take this a step further in the cynical direction and say it was surely bait for a Lindsey Graham or somebody else who is looking for an
opportunity. Well, Lindsey Graham is there.
He's there, but he's looking for something to offer his fellow Republicans to lure them. You could call it that, and I think they certainly have that hope. But it could also be just an attempt to say, look, if we put this out, you watch. You want us to be more bipartisan? You want us to be more cooperative Republicans? We're going to put this out there, and you watch what happens. And sure enough, the Republicans blasted it.
But
almost to a person.
Didn't go far enough.
Didn't go far enough. It's a quarter of a loaf. We don't trust the president to really issue the licenses and the leases to let this happen. Read the fine print, Lamar Alexander said. It was dissed, it was distrusted, and it was dismissed.
If the goal of President Obama, if you take out the Machiavellian approach to it, if you look at what President tried to do, win over a little bit of environmentalists by not going too far on drilling, win over some Republicans by giving them something, and yet I think he alienated both groups.
I think this does say something, and not to get too much on the soapbox here, but I do think this says something about how Washington has evolved. The way we are in this town now is that if you aren't with me 100%, I fire all my guns.
Right.
I let it rip. Because I have to have you 100% so I can go back and write my fundraising letter to my support base, whatever it is, left, right, up, down, and it has to be my way or nothing else. And there is no room for compromise. My hope is that when everyone has made their remarks on cable television and everyone's put out their press release, that then they do make the phone call saying, okay, maybe now we do find a basis where you get something of what you want and I get something of what I want.
I think you're more optimistic about this than I am because I see this almost as an extension of healthcare when there are some people who just didn't blink, didn't change their minds at all, didn't listen to the other side. I mean, you don't have to go back too far. The Clinton administration, the first Bush administration, the Reagan administration, meeting with both sides, giving a little to get a little. You don't find that now. I think Republicans and Democrats are equally at fault, but I don't see any change in that. And I suspect the same thing is going to happen with the climate bill.
And we must say, while the president gives with one hand, he takes away with the other. He made his bipartisan gesture on energy, but then he made his first recess appointments. Now, this is a controversial power that the president has, that if his appointees, his nominees for various government jobs are not being given a vote by the Senate, he can then appoint them when the Senate is out of town. When Congress is out of town, he can step up and say, well, you guys are out of town. I'm just going to put these folks into this job. And he put some people, including at least one very controversial person, into key jobs during this current congressional recess. 15 of them are now on their way into their new offices.
You know, for all the all the huffing and puffing about recess appointments, two things. First of all, yes, the controversial appointment was to the National Labor Relations Board, which is a pro-union guy.
Yeah, he works for SEIU and the AFL-CIO, Craig Becker.
But at the same time, go back to George W. Bush with John Bolton at the UN. That was a controversial recess appointment.
You could call it that.
Well, it was more than a controversial, but the point is presidents do it. Just like with reconciliation and demon path and all the things that one side gets so huffy about, both sides do it. Both sides always do it.
All right, what's the significance of the number 15? Why did President Obama choose to use exactly 15 when there are 77 ready for votes on the floor of the Senate? Why not 77? Why did he stop at 15?
Well, the reason they didn't want to do 77 is because of Ephraim Zimbalist Jr.,
who just recently died again.
No, he didn't.
15
no,
years ago.
No, but he's still alive, and he was the star of 77 Sunset Strip. It's the reason I mentioned that, which, of course. But the other reason is at this time in his presidency, George W. Bush had made 15 recess appointments.
Total coincidence.
Yeah.
I'm sure they didn't want that comparison made. No. And very few people wanted the Ephraim Zimbalist comparison made, although we have to give him credit. He outlived Robert Culp.
You're still into Robert Culp. But anyway, the reason we're talking about recess appointments is because Congress is on recess and things are going out on the states. Like, for example, in Texas this week, a shocking announcement.
This astonished
yes.
me. Kay Bailey Hutchison absolutely blew my mind because we all remember when she promised us she was going to leave the Senate right after the March primary. Let's listen to a little bit of what she had to say on this subject last year.
This is the time for a transition for the Senate seat for Texas. It's time for the new person to come in, and that person can start gaining seniority right now.
Those words have rung down the ages in Texas.
They have.
Kay Bailey Hutchison promised she was leaving.
She promised last year that she would be gone by the fall. Then she said, well, there is a health care vote coming up, so I'm going to stay until after the health care vote. Now, her mind was changed because all 20 of Republican House members in Texas passed around petition in Kay Bailey Hutchison's handwriting saying, please don't leave.
Including the ones who wanted to run for the seat.
Joe Barton,
once
right?
she had left. Had to be a tough call.
So anyway, she announced that she's not going to leave. She'll stay till her term expires in 2012.
Which is 2012. Yeah, she's got a couple, 3 more years.
But at 66, I suspect, well, here we go again, being surprised by what she has to say, I suspect she's not going to run for re-election. And there are no shortage of candidates. John Sharp on the Democratic side, Mike Williams on the Republican side, members of Congress, as you say. That Senate campaign is already starting now, even though it doesn't take place until 2012.
All right, we've got yet more escalation of the rhetoric down in Florida, where the hottest Republican primary for a Senate seat is going on in the country. That is, of course, Marco Rubio, the former speaker, running against the current governor, Charlie Crist.
You know, it's no longer in doubt, it seems, who's going to win that.
Just running away with this. Yeah. It's astounding to me.
And a matter of fact, I saw one recap of last week's debate on Fox, and they said the news of the debate is that Charlie Crist announced he will not leave the Republican Party to run as an independent. That shows how much
this
he's
is
fallen.
Not good for the Republican primary audience, no. Right? This is not the kind of thing you want to have be your bottom line.
No, I don't know how. I mean, we always talk about, everybody always talks about the amount of money Charlie Crist has, and far more money than Marco Rubio, and yet he's still trailing in double digits by every poll I've seen. I don't see how Charlie Crist comes back before the late August primary and beats Rubio.
Actually, I should mention another Senate primary in the Republican Party that is getting a lot of attention, even though I don't think it's anything like the kind of contest Florida has been, and that's the challenge from J.D. Hayworth in Arizona to their legendary John McCain, the presidential nominee of 2008. No one would have thought that John McCain had anything to worry about in getting reelected, except maybe possibly a Democratic challenger. But now he has J.D. Hayworth, former congressman.
John McCain, for all the complaints by conservatives about John McCain over the years on all the issues going back at least to 2000 when he ran against George W. Bush, but even before that, conservatives felt he was not the real deal. They said that he often talked a conservative game, but was really more moderate. That's J.D. Hayworth's argument. This is the first time that McCain has been challenged by the right in his primary. And speaking of the right, John McCain perhaps got one of the biggest heroes of the right on his behalf last week in Tucson.
Arizona, what do you say? Will you send the Maverick back to the United States Senate?
That, of course, Congresswoman, former Congresswoman Millicent Fenwick from New Jersey, a tremendous fundraiser and a crowd pleaser for the current...
No. That was not Millicent Fenwick. That was Sarah Palin, who used to be very close to John McCain.
That's what happened to Sarah Palin, because I've really been looking for the gal. I've been looking around, and now she's been... You know, really kind of a recluse for the last...
Well, if you watch the Discovery Channel. By the way, you know, she signed up for 6 episodes of her program about Alaska, $1 million a shot.
Also, the program that is running on Fox News features interviews with several famous people. Jack Welch, the longtime chairman of General Electric. Toby Keith, the country western singer. LL Cool J, the rapper. All of these interviews are featured on the show, but it appears by the announcement, at least from LL Cool J and Toby Keith, that the interviews were not done by Sarah Palin. They never sat for an interview with her, either of them.
But anyway, one point I want to make about Sarah Palin is that I wonder, you know, it was interesting to watch the crowd reaction at the Tucson rally for John McCain. Everybody loved Sarah Palin. Sarah, everybody was going. Matter of fact, whatever will be, will be. But the fact is, the people who were at the Tucson rally were far more interested in Sarah Palin than they were in John McCain. And I'm wondering what ultimate effect that Sarah Palin has when she campaigns for or against these candidates. The next day, I think it was the next day, she was in Searchlight, Nevada for a Tea Party rally where she railed against Harry Reid. I suspect she will be more effective attacking Democrats like a Harry Reid rather than trying to reelect Republicans whom Tea Party activists may have problems with, like John McCain.
In that same vein, she's been asking the Republican National Committee to take her name off a fundraising invitation at the Southern Republican Leadership Convention coming up in New Orleans. She doesn't really want to be that closely associated with the Republican Party, especially not the RNC right now, for obvious reasons, because she wants to, in a sense, declare her independence, have this connection with the Tea Party, have this connection with populism, and come out maybe once in a while for an incumbent like John McCain, because, after all, it would be disloyal for her to not campaign for the man who really created her national phenomenon.
But I don't know if she's separating herself from the Republican Party as much as, for instance, she didn't show up at CPAC either. And I think one of the reasons for that is if Tim Pawlenty and Mitt Romney and Bobby Jindal and all these would-be presidential candidates are appearing on the same stage, there's no reason for Sarah Palin to be one of them, because she is, after all, Sarah Palin and doesn't have to be one of the pack.
That is true, and that is it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week, and we do believe there will be a next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Hey, sera, sera, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see. Hey, sera.